Red Cow Arcade.
Well, we crossed a couple of Red Cow milestones in the last couple of weeks.
Did we?
Quite a few, actually. We have a lot of Red Cow business to attend to comment upon.
Tell me, because I have. It's been a long week.
Here, I'll enumerate them.
Okay.
Well, for one thing, your arcade video came
out. Oh, yeah.
Since the last time we spoke.
I've been hyping that for a while. And unlike some Nerd 200 episodes that I've been hyped for a while, I feel like mine was a little more paid off.
You offered something that hadn't necessarily been offered before. and we'll tease it. We're going to get into AVGN 200 a little bit.
A little bit. But I've been working on that one for a while. I was filming it in September, and so I've been working on it since then. And it's pretty complicated. It was a pretty complicated script with a lot of parts. So it was just like tough even for me to like follow everything, like, because I had to like remember all my steps and write them all down and like assemble them into a narrative that was cohesive.
Did it help that you had been collecting, like, did the B-roll kind of like jog your memory because you had been collecting the B-roll iteratively?
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, so I got the B-roll and I like referenced it as I was writing the script, but, and then the edit, you know, it's just, so you have to like remember again. So you're just like, okay, I said these things, but like, where exactly do they fit together? And yeah, it's,
I think it was our Discord friend from Liverpool, Dano Smith, said, that the shot that you apologized for that didn't achieve critical focus, he wishes, that any of his shots were as good as that shot.
Yeah, well, it was one of those. It was one of those things where, while I was doing the action, I'm like, oh, I didn't even focus when I was doing it. But I was like, I don't care, because I was so nervous about that. I mean, I wasn't like overhyping it. I was very nervous about that, applying that graphic, because.
So it was very well received. People seemed to really appreciate it, and even the guy that for whom you took inspiration for that cab, he saw it. He was like, oh, that's kind of like one I did. And he's like, oh, he actually says in the video that he was inspired by me.
Yeah, that was, man, it's a small world. And then like a coworker that I used to work with commented on that. He was like, oh, I didn't even know you were into these cabs. We should have been talking about them.
That's kind of cool.
It's like closeted, I don't know.
Yeah. People. Like, how else would you have brought up the topic if not make a highly produced 27-minute video about it first?
When, like, all we were talking about was, like, I don't know, marketing for retirement funds and stuff. So it's like, how does that come up? We don't know. But, it's kind of funny, the small world factor of it. Where and anybody who's into the community, the Arcade 1-Up community, was like, this is one of the, you know, best produced Arcade 1-Up videos I've seen.
That's definitely accurate, and I still at the turn of the year I intend on making my own. So we'll see. Assuming that I can even match 75% of that, we'll have two pretty good Arcade 1-Up videos. Not to mention we featured the stupid things in every one of our podcasts.
Yeah,
so
I mean it's right here.
We're in the bag for these things.
See Donkey Kong. I got Pac-Man. And there's Street Fighter 2. It's playing Street Fighter 1 right now.
I mean, I can't help but think yours will always be more valuable because it's a ground up. Like, if you want to mod something from scratch, here's how you would do it. If you wanted to make your very own cab, whereas mine's probably going to be like, here are reasons to buy or not buy Arcade 1-Up. And then if you want to mod it, here's the easiest possible way, you know, to play more games. Here's the easiest way to do that.
Yeah,
that's kind of, so maybe a lower level entry.
Yeah. I always describe this video as like a how to for nobody, because this is like very specifically something that I wanted to embark on and just document. And so,
isn't it funny that I saw a number of comments to the effect of like, oh, all the physical stuff, the carpentry, the painting, the, you know, anything to do with the physical build, I'm comfortable with. It's when you get into that computer shit that I start to get confused. And it's just really funny to me because I'm like, man, it's all of the physical stuff where I'm like, oh, I don't have confidence that I could do that well, or I don't have a lot of experience with that or whatever. But as soon as like I'm on a Linux machine, I'm like, oh, okay, like nothing can go wrong from here. Like if I break it, I'll reimage it, you know, yeah. Like totally not intimidated by electronics. And I was, and we'll get back to Red Cow business in a minute, but on a similar note, my elliptical, which I've been abusing, like just making it my bitch, my 140-pound weight loss bitch for a year and a half. It finally broke.
Wow.
It mid revolution yesterday, sweating balls on it, crunch, something just snapped. And, I fully intended to either buy a new one, maybe a more heavy duty one, given, you know, what my use level is.
Punishment.
Or, you know, I started to pursue repair service, you know, elliptical service people, which is its own difficult situation to navigate. But I just mentioned it to my dad. I was like, well, the elliptical finally broke. And he like came right over, this morning, and he was like getting real into the, like trying to fix the elliptical. It looks like he's going to be able to do it. He's going to have to weld like an Allen head back onto the plastic.
Oh, wow.
There's essentially a bolt and then a rod that snapped, and he thinks he can rebuild all that. And, but of course it's one of those things where it's, you know, it's a fairly complex build. And so to take it apart and then to put it back together again, that alone is a pain. But I'm sitting, you know, and there's a lot of rust. There's like a tremendous, anything that's metal is rusted the fuck over because you sweat into it.
Yeah.
It's just salt and water in that thing. And so like every screw is like locked tight, and it was, but I was like, I can't believe he feels like confident doing this. And he was like, Frank, all day long, I work with rusted shit. Like I fix engine rooms on yachts. Like that's what I'm a hydraulics engineer. Like rusty shit is what I work with. I'm like, man, I don't know how you don't go crazy. Cause like, I don't want to be anywhere near rusty shit.
Oh, it's like me with the LED trackball. I'm like, these LEDs aren't what I want. I know I can just open this up and replace the LEDs. I'm trained to be an electrical engineer. Right.
Well, that's your wheelhouse. I remember when I saw the control deck on my stock Mortal Kombat arcade 1-Up, and I saw like, the circuit board for those controls, I was like, this would be a pain in the ass to replace. Like even just replacing one of these would be like, there's just no way I would get it right. Like somewhere along. I remember one time I took apart a TV, to replace a ribbon, and then like, and it was a million parts just to get to ribbon. And then I was like, I couldn't put it back together again. I threw it out.
I mean, the great thing about online right now is that there's some guy who's made a video about whatever specific repair you have to do, and sometimes it's the only video on his YouTube channel, and he's just like, for some reason was inspired to like hook up a bunch of GoPros to himself and like fix it.
I like it because it's like the spirit is I don't, you know, I took a like many hours to figure out my problem. And I don't want you to have to do the same.
Yeah. That's how I felt about like the screen rotation thing that I was doing in the Donkey Kong. It's like, people were asking this question and like, I don't want you to have to look for it.
And then we, years ago, you put up a video. I mean, we're talking maybe 2017. I mean, it's 4 years ago, something like that. You put up a video saying like, hey, everybody, join our Patreon. If we cross $500 a month, we'll make Junt SNES. And then we made Junt SNES anyway.
Yeah.
But we actually did cross $500 a month, thanks to the lovely patrons that listen to this podcast. I suppose that we should address. I heard a piece of feedback.
Okay.
He's listening right now.
Yes.
That are and we got into a spat. I apologize for my aggression. That our top tier, because initially we had, when this was just a Patreon podcast, which it still is, of course, but the clips go public, we had said, like, oh, you know, because it was kind of like for like 20 people. So we're like, oh, if you want to donate $30 a month, we can have you on the podcast. And I don't know about you, but I feel like a little less comfortable with that now that we have sort of a flow and we have a setup. And also, we have a lot of new patrons that are here in many ways just for the AVGN slander.
And, the bottom feeding.
The bottom feeding. So I don't necessarily want, like, some weirdo from Scotland to come on and like just like call James Rolfe a wanker. but anyway, I fully recognize and acknowledge that if the reason you wanted to donate was to get extra content or bonus rewards or something, that we're not shilling it out properly. But look, it's a donation. It is saying, like, I like what you do. You have very few fans. You have very few likes. I want to help you. So if you want to do that, of course you should. But I think, I don't know about you, but like, I think $2 to get the full podcast is generous, but also kind of like reasonable, where nobody's going to pay more than $2 a month to listen to a fucking podcast anyway. But it's a good podcast. And we're consistent about it, and the Discord too. I mean, we give you a lot of dedicated time.
Yeah,
so we will talk to you. If you're donating a lot of money to us, I really appreciate it. Certainly, never feel any obligation to do that. My God, but thank you. You helped us cross the $500 mark.
Yeah, and if you like, think, you know, if you want to complain about it, just stop donating.
Yes, that's exactly my feeling on it, too. If you don't like what you're getting for your money, you should stop. And I don't say that snarkily. I really mean it. The point is that EJ and I are going as hard as we can. We can't go any faster or harder than this.
Yeah, unless somehow we break a threshold, then we can add more hours to it. But yeah, at this point in time, we are at our limits.
One of two things has to happen. Either our children need to get older and require less time, or we would need to quit our jobs and do this more full time and to do more. But I don't want to fucking hear it, because we make more content than a lot of other people. And I like to think that we offer a unique brand of content. So, you know, if we can't make you come, then we're not the right prostitutes for you.
But we appreciate everybody who is currently coming and currently giving us money.
Yeah, if you're coming. Yeah, I'm coming. It's like every day I listen to the podcast and I'm coming. there was somebody who, she's a longtime fan. She and her partner have been watching us for a long time. They're donating like $65 a month. Like, it's crazy.
That is crazy.
So that's like almost, that's like half of 500 right there.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful though.
And then on the numbers side of things, we crossed 16,000 subs on the main channel. That's kind of exciting. Yeah. That's like on its way to 20,000. 20,000 feels like I remember it was 10 not too long ago. Yeah.
It's been a good couple of years for the subscriber rate, and especially I think the new podcast clips actually helped a lot. So thank you to all the podcast fans that joined. And
it helps us a lot, because it's allowed us to increase the volume of content that we put out. Because if everything was as well produced as a Box Mac episode or an EJ Arcade episode or something like that, we would just necessarily have to go slower. It ain't like the good old days, the 2016 days.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. There's something I was thinking about, my personality type. So we did like every Sunday for years and years, you know, for like 6 years, we didn't miss a Sunday. For this past year, I've worked out for 2 hours a day. I've never missed it until the elliptical broke. I always was like, I gotta meet this like minimum quota thing. It's something about my personality, I think. The same goes for like, I had this job. I still have the job, but I was making this crazy commute every day for 15 years. And only now that I'm remote, would I not return to it if I was forced to. I realize about myself that, like, I keep holding myself to these sort of arbitrary standards, and then I stick with them forever. And they're often to my detriment that I do that. Whereas you might think it's like, well, that's good work ethic, or that's good consistency, or you're not a quitter, or something like that. But it's like, once we broke away from our main channel's content, here's the truth. I know we've joked about, like, the James Rolfe commentary hasn't really been, like, monetizable. But actually, in the last couple of months, it has been, in the sense that we've gained another channel that's being monetized, because we crossed 1,000 subs, and that's the minimum required for monetizing. And then we've picked up not a tremendous number of new viewership, but enough that it basically matches the viewership of the other channel, and we output more on the Podcast Clips channel. So it's all between attracting more patrons for the full pod and having another channel to monetize. We essentially, I'll give you the raw numbers. We essentially went from making like $6,000 a year off of all of Red Cow to about $12,000 a year at the current rate, if we don't slow down. So we essentially doubled our revenue for, you know, and $12,000 is no company at all, right? But it's something. That's quite a bit more than most people have. And it shows promise. And the point is like, what was I afraid of before? Was I afraid that, like, oh shit, if I slow down the content, well, I'll lose people, or we'll lose patrons or something. But instead it was like, the way smarter move is to innovate and to come up with some, you know, a new model. And it's a good lesson for me. Like, I should, you know, obviously working from home changed my life, made me rethink fitness and everything. Keep things moving, keep things changing. Cause you're not gonna grow standing still.
Yeah, and we've been loving the podcast. I think it is a different creative outlet, and I'm glad people have been enjoying it.
And I'm convinced that it would not have been successful on the main channel. Like, let's say we started uploading clips on the main channel.
Yeah, it's good to keep it separate. Definitely good to keep it separate. And
it's a different audience, actually. It's literally different people. So yeah, because that was the other side of it too. It was like, well, you know, a lot of people are there for the food and the junt. And it's like, well, no, they're at the main channel for the food and the junt. You make another channel. You know what? Now that I think about it, I remember a lot of people came to us through BAM Lounge,
right?
Who were very popular. And I remember asking those guys, I was like, every time you make a channel, you got like a million subs. What's going on with you? And he said, you know what we do is we eventually like retire every channel we make, and then we move on to another one. They were like, at some point, like, I don't know if he was indicting all of YouTube or the algorithm or just the general trend of fans. But he's like, eventually the thing stalls out and you can't grow it anymore. And the people that are watching only want one thing, and you can't innovate it. You can't innovate it on the same channel. You got to move to a different channel. And, again, we're talking very small numbers for us, but it sort of rings true. Like, cause yeah, it's like, how does somebody find the main channel? They were searching for a fucking mac and cheese recipe. They saw an episode of a goofy ass show called Box Mac. And then they're like, okay, that was pretty funny. That was pretty unexpected that I came across that. I'll watch another one. And before you know it, they're binging it, but they would be, some major percentage of those people would be surprised by anything that was divergent from that. And that's where another channel comes into it.
Yeah.
So.
No, it was a good lesson, and very surprising that we've had some success with diverging the content. It feels fresh. It feels fresh. It invigorates me to do different and more better things. So
I completely agree. I've all around this time last year, I was probably feeling the most negative about the prospects of the channel, or not the channel, but Red Cow, like, that I had ever felt. Because John's weight was a real problem, as I've talked about in the past, and it was starting to become like, am I really going to drag this guy through more content? And the Sunday schedule was untenable, or the weekly schedule was untenable. And so we put out that State of the Union where we were like, all right, let's relieve ourselves here a little bit. And then, yeah, like the podcast totally reinvigorated me. Like, I'm super happy with the current model. And I look forward to, that's the big lesson for me, is like, keep evolving it. Don't be like, oh, I got to do this or that, or, you know. Yeah. Good stuff. And then on the final or two final Red Cow notes, we discovered we got a beautiful email from Company Man. So if you know Company Man on YouTube, it turns out that he profiles major corporations, why they're successful, why they're not successful. It's a great show. If you love retail, you love John's car, this guy is like kind of owns that section of YouTube.
From 2018 to 2020, I think I watched him like during my lunch break, like every day or every time he posted something, I was watching some of his stuff. So it's very surreal to see this disembodied voice contact us.
Yeah, it turns out he's a big Red Cow fan and has been for years, which is just so weird. It's not the first time this has happened. You have Baby Back Maniac. You've got Freddie Williams. You've got who else? Cool Duder, Bam Lounge. It's there's probably others. There's probably successful people watching that don't call attention to themselves. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, so it's very surreal. It is a little bit of celebrity shock, even though it's just a disembodied voice on YouTube I listen to during my lunch break.
Yeah, it's weird for him to be like, tell Nina I said hi. and glow. Like, oh, shit, that's my family. But a similar thing happened where the Freddie Williams podcast that I did a clip of how he gets recognized from Red Letter Media. And that only a year later now has made its way around. Like there's a Instagram called Red Letter Media Things, and they uploaded it. And then the Red Letter Media subreddit put it up. And, you know, it's a well-received clip. It's a cool clip, and it's a cool interview with Freddie in general. If people haven't listened to it, they should. But there were comments that were like, oh shit, that's Frankie. You know, like, I didn't know you would be here. It's so strange because we have small numbers, and yet like we're marginally recognizable in fairly large communities. We've kind of, you know, between Lord of the Rings by George Lucas and all this, over the years, we keep kind of like just the tipping YouTube.
Yeah. Like, and I think that comes from our very enthusiastic fan base. Cause we have, you know, a small, but very enthusiastic fan, like very high engagement. So I think if they're in any other fan base, they'll be like, hey, it's Frankie.
I remember the Bam Lounge guys, when we were talking about their channel, they were like, well, you've got everything you need. And I was like, I have 1,000 views of video or something. And they were like, you've got alpha fans. You've got people who are really, really psyched about your content. And that's, it's, if we didn't have that strong core, we never would have made content at the rate. It's all we kind of needed was to know that there were people that really wanted to watch.
Yeah, so it's like if every week we filled a stadium with 2,000 people, you know, auditorium at least, not a stadium. Right.
If only we could figure out a way to really monetize it forever, permanently.
It'll happen. I think it'll happen.
That'd be good
because
we won't stop. I'd like to get out of Dodge.
We won't stop. It'll just keep going, and eventually, enough people will pay us.
Yeah, and are we? Here's a question: are we aging proof? Are we? Because you know, James Rolfe's not.
Well, the thing about innovating, like to go to Cinemassacre, you said it best. It's like he's his own cover band right now, where it doesn't feel genuine. It feels like he's imitating a former self. And
the balding sort of like highlights it.
Yeah. And the weird shirt and the like, I don't know. Yeah. And everything. Even like he's still on a futon, even though he's like 50. So it's like...
Yeah. Yeah. You would think maybe it's evident to him and or to Screenwave that it's time to innovate this thing, but they're innovating in all the most incidental possible ways. Like, how about a shirt with tons of buttons, or how about like we'll make the set smaller, whatever. Well, so he's been hyping ever since we made our video, James Rolfe's bizarre behind the scenes video, he's been saying, like, don't you want me to get to episode 200? He's really big into these kind of memorial centennial type things. And so indeed, he's released his 200th episode, which curiously was divided into three parts. He's released two. I've seen both parts now at the time of this recording. Yes. Have you seen them?
I have seen both of them. Correct. Yes.
So the concept was the LJN, the game company, has been a meme on that channel for a long, on that show for a long time as like, they're shitty games. And, oh no, not the rainbow of shit. And, I kind of appreciate it because it's not unlike the way we handle, you know, like cheese brands
or
at
Evil,
Halloween time.
Yeah. It's a good meme. It's solid classic art, angry video game nerd. It's a good thing to do for a 200th episode.
Yeah. Not a terrible premise, which was in celebration of the nerd, I'm going to review every single LJN game. And so the format will be, if I haven't reviewed it already, I'm going to. And if I have reviewed it already, I will show you a clip. And he's catching a lot of, I shouldn't say that. The subreddit is dishing a lot of shit.
The Cinemasker, Cinemasker Truth subreddit, to be specific.
Yes. Although the main Cinemasker subreddit is starting to just become an amalgamation of Cinemasker Truth. Because it really is like it's the most vibrant fan community for
that's where the energy is.
Well said, EJ. That's where the energy is. They're upset that, well, I don't know if they're upset. They're dogging on him for making a clip show. I don't know. Yes, it does strike me as lazy. But maybe more than that, it's like sitting on the futon and being like doing rants about conspiracy theories and all that. It's just like you said, it feels like a very tired joke, like an exhausted fucking joke, like that Tiny Toons Adventure episode where it's a lame joke comes out. It's like a clown that's got like a cane and he's coughing. that's AVGN now. But I think there was a good concept in there that I'm missing. Maybe part three will bring it home. But I don't at all hate the idea that it would be the ultimate troll. Not unlike me helping Justin lose weight. It would be the ultimate troll to acquire LJN and re-release its games.
Yeah, and I thought that was actually a good concept. I thought the execution was like kind of weird. Like it was almost confusing. Where he's like, I have a piece of paper here, and it says I own LJN. It's like it didn't make. I don't know.
Yeah, I was like, what the fuck are you talking?
And it was
about?
like a boring like flat shot, and then he was, and I was like after a green screen of like these were my LJN kills, and it was very awkward.
And then you must have seen that on his podcast, his wife made him a cake with 200 on it. It's cute. No, but he was celebrating it before the episode came out. He's like 200 guys. And so of course the assholes of the asshole-ish variety, they've been, you know, meme, the cake gets different things on it and stuff. Very, very brilliant. But yeah, he then released a new episode of his podcast after he released episode 200 if you haven't watched the show, it's like, we think that he's saying that he acquired LJN and now he's going to, his team is going to develop an NES game, an actual NES game. And it's confusing in episode because it's not linked to any kind of story.
Yeah.
But then on the podcast, Big Ryan explains that they are going to make a new AVGN installment, video game installment, on NES.
Big Ryan so fan, like by fun, the way.
Big Ryan fan, BTW. paren. So, I think that's cool. They were kind of going over, like, I appreciate, a lot of the whimsies that they were talking about, like, what are their favorite projects that they've ever done for AVGN and for Cinemasker. And they were saying, like, they released this big Blu-ray volume where they had empty slots, so you could sort of buy the disc and put them in the empty slot. So you'll have a box set, even though the show is not complete. I appreciate that sort of thing. They put together a really big AVGN the movie Blu-ray, and despite the fact that movie is really bad, I'm in it for the special features, and they got some pretty good special features on that thing. Horrible commentary track aside, but I appreciate all the little featurettes and that sort of thing. What else were they to this NES game? It's a cute idea. It's not exactly profit chasing, is it? I mean, it's not going to help anybody. It's a very boutique idea.
I found it fairly annoying within the episode, though. Like,
within the episode, it made no sense.
Like, because he like goes over the computer and like it's like scripted weird, and so he just sounds like angry and rude to this like beta British person.
Who shouldn't be acting.
So it's just like. He's just like being like really low, what is that called? Low energy, low stakes,
low tea.
Low tea. And he's just like, oh, whatever, I'm making a game. And then he's just like being like rude and bossy to him. And I'm just like, I don't know if this is comedy.
Yeah. We should dwell on this for another moment. Because I think you're spot on. You're on to something. Like there, it's like who was inspired to write that sequence of dialogue?
It did, because it didn't feel like he wrote it. So then he delivers the lines weird, and then like the guy on the other end just delivers it in like the weird submissive British voice, and then you're just like, I don't know what I'm looking at.
So what your brain takes in is, I think they're promoting something, but I'm not sure what. Or I think this is leading up to a promotion.
I didn't even know. I thought it was just like a gag gone wrong. So if it was leading to something, I didn't know.
But it's edited. You can't go wrong. You edit it out if it went wrong. And wouldn't you also, if you cared about this sort of anniversary 200th episode sort of thing, wouldn't you not split it into three shows? Wouldn't you make it just a really big sort of gigantic I mean, maybe if he releases an hour and a half long show, nobody watches it. Maybe that's the concern.
Could be. But I don't want to like rag on this thing too much, because part two came out today and I watched it, and there was quite a few like gags, and I can't even recall the gags, but I chuckled. I was like, oh, this is kind of fun. Some of the things felt more energetic, like more genuine. Every time he like gets to something more genuine is when I start to enjoy him again.
Yeah, mostly making fun of the sports games, because it's true that like there's almost nothing to say about sports games, but he dug a little deeper and was like, well, what do I give a fuck if it's grass or turf?
Exactly. Yeah.
I actually thought fuck was kind of funny. I think sports games need to be shat on more. But what I think this is true even of his good older episodes and stuff. Marathoning the games, like just kind of rocking through games, is not the best way to deliver this comedy. I think like it works best when you spend time nitpicking or really being frustrated by an aspect of a game or a couple of games, but being like, this one sucks, nothing to say about it though, and moving on to the next one is just boring.
Yeah, and encompassing this whole 200 episode endeavor, it's better when there's like a narrative to the video. And I don't feel like there is a narrative. There's just like things. There's like, oh, there's the beta British guy saying something and he's yelling at him. Here's some shitty games, and here's some clips. Here's some this. I'm in front of a green screen saying these are my kills, which is really awkward. And like, yeah. It's like
some of it feels AI generated.
Yeah, it feels like the cover band stuff where it's just like, this is what the nerd is supposed to do, maybe. And then there are glimmers of genuine, maybe James Rolfe stuff with the sports stuff where I'm like, oh, this could be compelling. So it's just, you know, if I'm going to dissect a YouTube video, that's what That's what I'm going to say.
Well, you know, it's funny because we've now gained a reputation for doing what we're doing right now, talking about AVGN. And I never really wanted to, like, deconstruct an episode per se. Like, I don't, you know, I obviously think that it's gotten real dry and real tired and there's not much left to say here. But if it's your thing, it's your thing. It's, you know, I don't care. All I ever wanted to do, EJ, was critique his technical setups. That's all I ever wanted to make fun of because it's too fucking ridiculous. And I don't want, well, and the time management thing. The time management thing, and then, which he then answered. Everybody said, "What's going on with your time management?" And then he was like, "Wait till you see my room."
Wait till you see and my, then he showed you the room. And you're just like, "What's going on?"
And that was, we were talking in Discord about it the other day, and I was like, I had to watch it 18 times before my brain recognized it as a real video. Like, I thought, like, it more matched a dream I might have had about, like, I had a dream that James Rolfe was like, "No, I do have time. It's just that there's shit on the ceilings.
And I drilled through my childhood desk, and the server was loud, and I had to put it in the other room and pad it."
Like, it didn't seem conceivable to me that he would ever acknowledge that subreddit on any level. And so, like, I remember just being glued to it. I was like, he's talking about it. He's addressing the 14,000 strong.
No, it's all fascinating to me. Even just deconstructing what he's doing now. It's, I don't know. It's fascinating. It's fascinating that this whole man, this endeavor, this downfall, this any glimmer of hope. It's all interesting to me.
Well, you know what? So we've received a lot of negative criticism for being like, you're being mean. It's, you know, people don't know quite how to say that sometimes, but a lot of people are like, you're being cruel. You're being dicks. You're being nitpicky. Yeah, you're being petty. Well, so here's the question. It's like, yes, if I was talking about, like, a citizen, a private citizen, which, you know, he is, but he's obviously a celebrity, then I think I would, like, hear that out a lot more. But I think we can all agree that there's some relationship between how public of a personality you are and how reasonable it is for people to talk about your work and criticize you and love you or dislike you or whatever. Like, I feel like if you and I every week, like, well, we do, came here and we're like, all right, let's talk about what we do and don't like about Marvel. Nobody would be like, guys, this is real petty now about Marvel.
Yeah. That's the way I see it completely. It's like if Coca-Cola makes a screwed up flavor, I'm going to be like, oh, that's a bad flavor, Coca-Cola. And you're going to be like, that's really mean to Coca-Cola. It's like, no.
But I am sympathetic to the argument that even though he's a pretty huge e-celebrity, it's not maybe quite the same. Like, he still is a guy making shit out of his garage, and it's not quite the same as picking on Robert Downey Jr. Yeah. or something.
But he's getting a lot of help, though.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Is like,
you don't want to beat him up for getting help, guys.
Yeah. What do you want me to do, suffer? There are channels that are as big as him or bring in as much money as he does that invest a lot heavier in their production equipment and their spaces and all that sort of stuff. And I feel like people wouldn't be so critical if we were critical of those channels. There's something about their presentation that's more legitimate. It's actually sort of his delegitimacy that I think makes people go like, hey, hey, go easy.
Oh.
Did you see some genius on the Reddit? Fucking genius.
Some genius.
Did before and afters of, because the nerd room is now in a garage. And he showed how big the old set was using the same camera setups. You can see how much more space there was before and how little space there is now. And it was pretty fascinating. And it really does kind of like mess with the way you take in the information.
Hmm.
Feeling like he has no room in there. Yeah. I'm sure it limits the creativity. He basically admitted that.
Yeah.
He did admit that. He's like, I can't do as much as I want to do in
here. I do appreciate, like, you can tell they're trying to do some things that are more ambitious. Like, he'll, like, walk out of the frame and then, like, sit down. Like, it changes the angles a little bit. They're trying to mix it up.
It reminds me of when I was in high school, I took a video class and we did something called the continuity exercise.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. Yes.
Where, like, and you know, one of the first things you learn is, like, if somebody walks out of frame, then it's much easier to give the illusion of continuity, because, you know, because you don't have to find the exact place where they were last in the shot. And it feels like I'm watching a high school continuity exercise.
Yeah, that is so perfect. some of those shots where they're like, you can see him, he walks out of frame, and it's like, it's a little bit slow too, and then he like sits down on the futon, like, after walking out of the frame. Like, yeah, it's a continuity exercise.
The moment for me in the first part when he was in front of the green screen in like a dungeon.
Yeah.
That was the part where I was like, what the fuck? Like, I don't want to watch this at all. I was like, for the 200th episode, you couldn't like muster up the juice to not do this green screen trash thing.
That's why when I watched the second part alone, where it didn't have that framing device, I actually enjoyed it more, because he wasn't like trying to put the framing device on it. But you still got the, you know, the beta British guy. But
yeah, all right, nerd. Yeah, put clocks in there. Mm-hmm. That guy shouldn't have been it. Somebody made a terrible mistake.
It's different than clocks.
We were laughing on Discord about like, instead of you know what's bullshit, instead of the bullshit man, you have the I don't give a fuck man. It's, you know, it's a little keyframe animation of James in Final Cut 7, like not giving out shits. I'm not giving out fucks. And he's like, you know what I don't give a fuck about? Content. Producing it. I got to do it all the time. And then you got to hire slobs. But nobody likes the slobs. I want to make that video. You want to be famous, EJ? We make that video.
we should. Well, you know, if you need help animating.
And that's
it.
Why I don't give a fuck. I don't give a fuck.
We have to make this now.
Yeah. It would be so easy. Because you use like stock images from Google Image Search that still have the watermarks on them and stuff, and you just kind of slow zoom on them to like make your point about your hastily written script. So then you got to buy a house for your kids, but the only space you have is a garage. Oh, great. Now I got to rebuild my whole set in a small garage. I'm drilling holes in desks.
My childhood desks.
And now I'm in anti-gravity because the fucking lights are on the ceiling. What the fuck? I don't give a fuck. Yeah.
Oh,
gotta do it.
We gotta do it.
Gotta take the plunge and make that video. I pretty much have his cadence down.
Yeah, you do. It's uncanny.
It's uncanny. Yeah, that would be really great.
Well, you put a short clip on the Cinemassacre Truth subreddit, and they loved it. So
why so many shitty games? Oh, cursed me. Cursed to the bowels of hell. God, it's so annoying.
Anyway, yeah, we're mean, so.
Am I doomed forever to review these games again and again? And then it's the LJN rainbow of shit. It's like beat poetry.
It is.
There's nothing there. It's like we're fucking eating rice cakes.
We're all snapping after he says it.
Yeah, it's very nice, very nice, very nice.
Yeah, shitty games, yeah.
Big Ryan fan, by the way.
Big Ryan fan.
All right, that's enough of him. Oh, I'll say one last thing. I think they had floated the idea of doing a chronologically confused about AVGN DVD releases. I think that's a genuinely good idea. They should do that. I think that's the kind of meta I'm looking for from that channel. Because I actually really enjoyed his chronologically confused videos back in the day. And he's caused the same sorts of release problems with his content that he complained about with, like, Ninja Turtles and stuff. I think that'd be fun.
Yeah, it'd be funny.
And, yeah, one of his many mispronunciations is Super Nintendo, where he doesn't enunciate the N. And when we posted the clip of what was your favorite console as a kid? Everybody said Super Nintendo in the comments. Now I listen for it.
During the second part, I've heard Super Nintendo like so many times.
It was like a Christmas of Super Nintendos.
And in the Super Nintendo version, he's like.
Well, should we talk about 8-Bit Christmas?
We should.
Yeah.
That was a pleasant surprise.
I liked it.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
It, there's so many shitty games. There's so many like bad Christmas movies out there. And people were talking about 8-Bit Christmas, so I threw it on. And it reminded me, you know, it reminds you of Christmas Story. It reminds you of, you know, Princess Bride, like, you know, the telling of the story. And eventually the kid wants to hear more of the story, that kind of thing.
A little Home Alone in there, a little bit of like kids on a mission type stuff.
Yeah, a little bit of that 80s nostalgia thing going on, you know, Stranger Things kind of thing.
Nintendo.
But yeah, in like the Nintendo-ness of it was a bit incidental. It could have been like a Furby Christmas or something, you know. It could have been
which is really what made it work, cuz I think most people reasonably were skeptical of, like, are you just trying to get my money by mentioning Nintendo? Doing the mini console thing, the nostalgia bait is what they call it. Where it's getting tired. We've seen Stranger Things. We've seen It. Hey, remember the 80s? Listen to my synth soundtrack thing is a bit played out. But I agree. It was really more about. As I was watching it, I have only one critique, really, which is I thought that some of the humor, not a lot, and not enough to tip the scales, but some of the humor was relatively modern in the way it was sort of self-aware or a little bit meta. Like, there was that bully character who was I thought the kid was a genius performer. Like, the actor was amazing.
I loved his introduction where he's on, like, the mountain. And they were like, for some reason, we just, like, went up there. And that reminded me of my childhood so much, where there was just, like, situations where there's, a big kid who just wants to beat you up, and you just were, like, gravitating toward him. That reminded me of my childhood so much.
Yeah, we don't even know why we did it, yeah. Or even, like, acknowledging, like, yeah, you probably wouldn't be made fun of for purple boots today, but we were made fun of for purple boots back then.
Yeah.
But I thought some of the humor was a little too clever. Like, sometimes it was a little on the cleverness side, but it didn't, it never ruined it. But I was worried about it. And I was like, man, I hope this movie ends up having stakes. I hope that it's about something. I hope it's like not just here to like kind of tickle me with quips, mention Nintendo and get out of here.
Yeah. They only had, like, the license for Midway games, so you only saw, like, Rampage and, like, Paperboy.
Oh, yeah, that actually took me out of it. In the Power Glove scene, when they were playing some, like, sort of fake indie game or something.
Yeah, because the graphics were too good, and also fighting games weren't really a thing in 1988. But anyway. And the Power Glove wasn't released until 1989, by the way.
Yes. But it was about family, and not in the way that The Last Jedi supposedly was.
Or like Fast and Furious.
It's about family. Yeah, exactly. It really is about, like, and I think the framing device of, like, hey, I want a phone. Well, let me tell you about the time I really wanted something for Christmas and I got something better. It's great, you know, because then it makes it, that really helps make it not so much about Nintendo. It's just that, like, you know, when I was your age, I wanted something lo-fi. Well, when my dad was my age, he wanted something lo-fi by today's standards. And yeah, just I don't want to ruin it for anybody. So spoilers for the next couple of minutes if you haven't seen 8-Bit Christmas yet. But it really sticks the landing at the end where you go. It's the natural thing of like, we tried everything to get this Nintendo and we failed at every turn. And I really thought I was going to get it that Christmas. And instead of getting that, I got something that that was important to my dad, which is that my dad is a carpenter and he built this beautiful treehouse that I played in every year constantly. It's where all my friends hung out. It's where we had all of our best memories. I love my Nintendo too. But like my dad made me this, and then in the future you sort of discover that the dad passed away that you know earlier that year.
Yeah,
and it was like,
and it does a very clever thing where it actually when I was watching the movie I was a bit frustrated because they do the whole like doofy dad thing, you know the doofy dad thing, and I was like, oh, this is awful, I hate this. But then like when they bring it around to the end. When perfect. It was perfect because it's like, oh, he just doesn't appreciate what his dad's doing. He doesn't appreciate what his dad's bringing to the table until the end. And then like they use something, they use that frustration, like, you know, cause you got that in like the Christmas story, you have the doofy dad, you know, it's a tired trope. So they actually use that to tell a really compelling ending in the story.
Yeah, he wasn't just some piece of shit or he was a guy who loved his family and wanted to make something memorable for his kids. It was really nice. There's other things like when he was made to pick up the poop in the yard and the kid goes like all the kid wants to do is go inside and play Nintendo and he's like, I don't like doing stuff like this, dad. I was like, wow, I really relate to that. It was, I mean, in an otherwise pretty cynical world where it's hard to make something innocent, it's hard to make something about something as simple as our family relationships. It was just, you know, especially during Christmas, which is almost itself, I think, cliche for a lot of people, Christmas entertainment. So there's so much, this is what I'm trying to say. There's so much temptation. There's so much urging to make it subversive.
Yeah.
To make it a parody of what it's homaging.
Or make it overly cynical or something like that.
Yeah. And instead you told a story about Christmas, which like, we've gotten so far from that. I almost didn't think it was possible.
I know with like, what's that Seth Rogen thing? Like Santa Inc or whatever, where it's just like some cynical horseshit. And like,
and it's great to see the world reject it because it means it might be time to be like enough with like, and look, like I'm guilty too, man. Like cause I grew up with Full House and sitcoms and, you know, and all you want to do is make fun of them because they're also so dopey. But I sometimes also think that like, there's something I wanted to talk to you about. I think that the audience, let's say, you know, however many millions of people own HBO Max or any one of these platforms, I think the audience is more innocent than a lot of creators think they are. Mm. I don't think that that filmmakers or artists are often as innocent as the audience itself. And so the creators are always kind of whipping this clever, cynical shit at the audience. And the audience is kind of like, you know, moderate IQ, kind of like simple people. And I mean that in a good way. Like, they're like, why are you giving me this subversive thing? Why are you like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and what I like about this movie is I think it is clever and it does know what it's doing, but it doesn't succumb to that temptation ever. Like I feel like it was sincere the whole way, and it told a story that was relatable. It told a story that was rooted in the 80s because there's a lot of stuff. Like I had that exact jacket the main character had.
Oh, wow.
And like it was like the pad, like the gray like top and the blue bottom, like I had the same. I could probably find that picture of me with that jacket. And so it's just like it did those touchstones like member berries, but then it incorporated in an actual sincere story about, you know, generations and families. And it was awe-inspiring. I didn't even think like a filmmaker had it in him. You know?
Right. Right. It's promising. It means that maybe we're turning a corner on the way that we regard our entertainment, that maybe we want to make something for the human spirit.
Yeah. Instead of something that like is, it will endure and not just deconstructing.
Yes, exactly. What was I going to say? I don't know if you've ever seen, if you want something that hit, checks all these same boxes that we're talking about. Did you like the Wonder Years growing up?
I don't think I've watched enough of it. I remember it being on in general when I was a kid, but I don't remember much about it.
There's an episode. I think their first Christmas episode. So Fred Savage is like younger, like it's one of the first seasons, and it's in the 70s, and the kids want a color TV, and the parents are never going to be able to afford a color TV, and so it's like a non-starter, and it follows a similar thing of like the kids just get obsessed with this Christmas present that they're hoping for, and they're looking for any loophole they can find to get it, and the family like is having a hard time gelling because the father has like a personality disorder and he is not a doofy dad. He is a pissed dad. He is a 70s dad. And I'll tell you, I have a 70s dad, even though I grew up in the 90s. My dad's a little bit older. My dad's not pissed, but he's got a more, patriarchal kind of regard for the family, a little bit of distance, like emotional distance. And anyway, it's a beautiful 25 minutes of TV. It really, like, that's another one to put on for Christmas. There's this scene where he finds out that, like, his crush, Winnie, that her older brother died in Vietnam. He had, and he knew, but he forgot that would matter to her on Christmas. And so that kind of, like, creeps up out of nowhere. And, spoilers, much like 8-Bit Christmas, they do not get the color TV. He's like, and we did get that color TV 3 years later, we wanted it. We didn't get it. It's good stuff, man. That's the kind of holiday entertainment I'm looking for.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this is actually a good movie, and I think it'll endure, which is, you can't say a lot about the Christmas trash movies that they pump out. So.
Oh, and that's the other thing is that, I sometimes wonder, I'm like, all right, for, I don't know, what's an HBO Max subscription cost? 14 a month?
It's something like that. 14, $10. I don't know. I just pay it.
I wonder, they're making a few billion dollars a year or something. And I often wonder, like, what does that pay for content? Because on the one hand, they want good. They're not going to shovel trash onto the platform if they can help it.
Mm-hmm.
That goes for all of these. So you want premium stuff, but you also can't spend $100 million on every one of your projects. You're not Netflix and taking out loans constantly.
Yeah.
I think for a while, like the superhero genre for theatrical releases kind of like eclipsed, like we used to get $10 million, $30 million comedies all the time in theaters.
Yeah.
And then that just kind of stopped. It was like, nobody's going to go to a theater to watch a $30 million comedy. And now this fell, I don't know what the budget was on this. My guess would be like 25 mil. And it's kind of like the perfect, like, it's almost like a master class. And like, this is exactly the, for production quality, the minimum that you're going to get on a platform like this, or they spent the minimum that they can spend on for content like this. And then the content itself is really strong, which brings it over the line and says, yeah, that was kind of worth the subscription fee for that viewing.
Yeah, that's the thing is it, when I saw it and enjoyed it, I was like, wow, I enjoyed a non-superhero movie. it was like a rarity. It was nice. And it wasn't bogged down by low budget or anything. It looked like a theatrical film,
but we wouldn't have watched it if there wasn't the Nintendo connection, probably. So still, there's still like a marketing laundering effect. It's sort of like how Joker was not really about the Joker, but they called it Joker to make a cool movie.
Yeah, I'm okay with that. There was enough fun Nintendo jokes. I love the Nintendo kiosk, who is just like, where's your sister?
That was great. That was super fun.
That was pretty fun.
The retainer stuff is genius. I love the joke about, like, my dad made it clear what to do if I lost my retainer. Don't come home.
Yeah.
And he was like, I have no idea what it costs. I assume it's the cost of a new car or something.
That's great.
And I liked it so much that I put it on with my kid.
Yeah.
Who's 4 and doesn't normally respond very well to live action stuff. But she does love me, like, live narrating. If I'm engaged and I'm telling her what's going on the whole time, she's pretty into it. So she learned about what a retainer was, and she loved it. And yeah, there's basically no swearing in the thing at all.
Yeah.
Even though it doesn't feel utterly innocent. It doesn't feel like it's for little children or something. It's a good family movie. We've talked about this before, where it's like the family genre went away.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You get your 4-quadrant Pixar type films, but this idea of, like, I'm going to watch something that's kind of cute that we all enjoyed on our own levels has gone away.
Yeah. Especially important as I'm getting older, you know, and as, you know, I'm making YouTube videos that are more family friendly.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
It's like, I feel like I'm growing up and I'm appreciating when filmmakers actually make something that appeals to all ages. But it's not childish, but it's not, like, crass, you know?
Right, right, right. It doesn't insult your intelligence, but it's also not gratuitous or makes it so that only a segment of the audience could possibly watch it. I sound like an old man. I can't believe I'm saying this.
Yeah, well, whatever. I'm good with it. Is it?
Well, on the topic of Christmas, I wanted to bring up a small item. This is about meme culture. Did you notice that for a while there, you know, and when people are making fun of Basic Bitches and that sort of thing, you would get made. There was a lot of negative sentiment around putting up your Christmas tree early or drinking pumpkin spice around the fall. And then there was a counter meme that I think has been alive and well for a good 5 years, which was like, put up your Christmas tree early and drink your pumpkin spice. And now I barely remember when everybody was mad about putting up your tree early. These things go through cycles.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. Well, it's like the thing where, what is it? Yeah, like Halloween ends, and then, like, they're like, Mariah Carey comes out of nowhere and, like, starts being in every, like, mall.
Does Gabe have a favorite Christmas song? Is he into Christmas? It's his birthday at the time.
Yeah,
of this recording.
It's his birthday today. He had a great birthday. He got a Bowser castle. He got He actually got a little music player. It's like a Yodo. It's called the Yodo player. It's really cool. It's like it's basically like a fancy Bluetooth speaker that you get these little cards that you can put into it. So he has like classical music that you can just like put into it.
Oh, wow.
And you can program your own cards. So you could put like Mario music on it and you could put it in there and he can control it himself. It's pretty nice, especially because if you don't want him to like play with the iPad or something, you know, and just,
yeah,
so you could just play with this music. It's like very intuitive. It all has 2 like knobs on it. So it's like for pre-readers, it's very great. He loves that. Because he loves music, because he can play things by ear. He played the Legend of Zelda theme by ear.
Wow.
And the only reason he knows the Legend of Zelda theme is because there's a secret in Mario 3D World that has that theme.
Really? Yeah. I've never come across that.
Yeah, there's like a secret bonus in one of the levels where you basically fill out a Link sprite from Legend of Zelda. And then it plays the Legend of Zelda theme. And then he went over to the piano and started doing like doo 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 doo.
Wow.
I caught some of it on camera.
I was putting her to bed tonight and she wanted to, we were playing Mario 64 on the arcade, which is pretty fun. And she was like, I want to watch a Super Mario Brothers thing. And I said, well, there's a Christmas episode from Super Mario Brothers Super Show called Koopa Claws. And, Toad wants a snowboard for his Christmas present.
So really good impression. You, the nerd and Toad.
Yeah. The I don't give a shit, man. But she, the live action segments with what's his face, with Lou Albano, I forgot they were going to be there, and she was like, what the fuck is this? She actually got up and did the Mario, because I was singing along to it. I was like, swing your arms, and she was like, all right, from side to side, come on, it's time to go. But and what's contained in every one of those Super Mario Brothers Super Show episodes is this is what reminded me of it. They go, watch this clip from the next episode of Legend of Zelda. And they show like upcoming Legend of Zelda show. And she was like, what's this? Because she knows what Zelda is too, from me playing it. But anyway,
yeah, he knows that, like, Zelda, because, you know, Link's Awakening, there's a Switch version. He likes the thumbnail of it because Link looks like a Sprix, the Sprixy princesses in Mario 3D World. He kind of looks like a Sprixy in that. So he's like, oh
yeah, totally.
He, like, the little eyes and stuff. But yeah, he got that castle. He's a clever boy. It's so weird that he's five, and that 5 years ago I had to duck out on a Boxmack Christmas special.
I remember it well. We at the end of the episode, we mentioned, like, EJ's out there having a kid right now. And you were the first of us, of that group, to have a child, and Glow followed 6 months later.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I remember you telling me you were having a kid in the car. We were driving, we went to go get pizza.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it seems weird that we would have been doing that instead of shooting something.
Yeah, we usually never hang out if we're not doing content.
We do this, or we're setting up tripods when we converse. Well, on a similar Glow note, we were watching Muppet Christmas Carol, and she was kind of freaked out by Statler and Waldorf when they play Marley and Marley, which I'll remind you, because John has only ever seen the Muppet Christmas Carol, he is, I think to this day, probably thinks that it's the Marley brothers, and not just a single Marley. It was so funny. And it's in the Abington episode where he's like, oh, look, it's Marley and Marley. I was like, you're thinking about Muppets. But she was watching that. She was like kind of freaked out by the ghosts. But she likes to hear about, like, so it's green screen, and then they put them in, and then there's people underneath. And I was like, yeah, they're probably dressed in black doing the puppets. And she was like, show it to me. And I looked everywhere for behind the scenes clips of Muppets or Sesame Street, and they don't exist. The Henson Company really protects that sort of thing. They don't want you seeing anybody with a hand up Kermit's ass or anything.
Well, that's because they're actually like genetic freaks. They're not actually puppets.
Yes.
they're human hybrids.
I remember that Labyrinth, the Jim Henson directed, George Lucas produced film of the 80s, did have like a deluxe behind the scenes documentary, and it showed Brian Henson and everybody puppeteering people and stuff. I was like, oh, that's what I'll show her. So we watched the whole fucking documentary about the making of Labyrinth, and she was super into it. I was like, this is my kid, man. She wanted to know, she loved, and when Jim Henson was on screen talking about, like, so we wanted to find somebody who was sort of like a contemporary actor. And I was like, who does that sound like to you? And she's like, Kermit the Frog. And I was like, yeah, but that's the man who does Kermit the Frog. I said, but when he's with his family, he's just like, all right, everybody, we're all going to put our hands together and say grace. I said, but when he does Kermit, he goes, yay! So we all around the house, we've been doing, like, all right, do family Kermit. Now do, like, puppet Kermit. So she'll do it. She'll be like, okay, everybody.
Now do Jordan Peterson.
Yeah, exactly. But then she wanted to see the real movie with David Bowie and his bulge and the whole thing. And I was like, well, fuck, man. Like, this all started with she was scared of ghosts. Now I'm going to show her an infinitely more frightening Jim Henson experience with Labyrinth. I mean, Labyrinth isn't scary per se, but it's not really for four-year-olds. And but we watched it because she already had all the insight about the making of. She wasn't scared of it at all.
No.
She thought it was super cool. So that's my advice to anybody out there with kids that are scared, is like, see if you can show them the behind the scenes first. Because kids don't care about spoilers either, by the way.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah. Who cares? Especially because kids watch movies like 1,000 times. So it's like, what's a spoiler to them?
Yeah.
Like,
now she's into it. She it puts her in the mood of like, all right, what could She started saying, she's like, can we make Labyrinth 2? Like, she wants to make a sequel to it.
I remember when Ghostbusters 2 was out. So I must have been 4. And I remember, and I was watching Ghostbusters 1 on a taped VHS from a television airing of it. And I remember my sister saw it before me, and she came home, and I made her tell me the whole plot before I saw it.
Oh, wow.
So I remember that. I remember her being like, these are all the jokes that happen. This is the plot. I'm like, good, good. Now I'll be primed to see it.
Yeah. It's almost easier for a child, I think, to know what's going to happen. They can enjoy it on a better level. I think it happens. Like, I'll be watching a movie with her and I'll be like, but something's gonna, you know, I'll tease it. I'll be like, something's gonna happen. She'll be like, what? And she just needs to know right away. And she enjoys it so much more if I just tell her.
Yeah.
So that's cool. I don't know if this kid has a future in filmmaking. God help her if she does, but
she might get shot by Alec Baldwin.
Oh my God, dude. I mean, should we talk about that? Did you see the documentary? The interview?
No. I heard about it. I haven't seen it, but
I don't know if I have a lot to say about
it. No, I don't either, but it's just weird. The whole thing's weird.
The interview was really, really odd. I kind of felt like the thing had, from a public relations point of view, had already blown over for him to then circle back and be like, I want to talk about this again.
Yeah, I actually, if I was him, I would just not say anything. Yeah. Because I think most people have forgotten about it. And then when you bring it up and now you have clips of you saying stuff, it's like, maybe you shouldn't have.
But I was sympathetic to some of his arguments. Like, it's really, again, it's from a public relations point of view, it's not a great idea to say some of the things he said. And yet I kind of agree with him. He was like, look, how many bullets have been fired on sets? And how many times has an incident like this happened? It's in other words, for people to be like, movie sets are too dangerous is kind of an overstatement. I mean, just based on the raw numbers,
no.
Like, clearly a freak accident happened here. And somebody needs to get to the bottom of how that live round ended up in that gun, because that's the freak accident. But to be like, that's it. We're always slaughtering people on movie sets. It's just untrue.
Yeah, it's untrue. It's just, it's a very, very unfortunate situation.
It's terrible.
And you know, we'll figure it out. I don't want to like cast judgment on Alec Baldwin until I hear all the story. Because he has a public relations person putting out information, you know, you don't know what's happening. So
he said something about like, he didn't actually pull the trick. Like, he's like, oh no, my training tells me I would never point the gun and pull the trigger at somebody. It was that, like, for the shot, I was pulling back the hammer and she kept telling, you know, we were rehearsing it. She was telling me to pull it back more. And then when I released it, that's when it fired or something. Yeah. Like, it was, so there was other,
that's not how,
I don't quite understand.
Yeah. I don't know if that's how guns work. He would have to actually been squeezing the trigger. So he could have been having his finger on the trigger and pulling back the hammer. And then it went off, but
or he made another good point about, like, on one hand, everybody's, you know, like, anybody who's into gun safety or has taken a gun safety training class or something, they all tell you, like, well, you never, you know, one of the, like, rule number one is never point and shoot at something unless you intend to kill it. It's like, yeah, unless you're on a movie set. That's the thing, guys. It's like, it's you on the movie set, you point guns at things and fire, and it's supposed to not kill anybody. So it is a totally different set of rules.
Yeah. No, I don't know. We'll see.
But George Clooney had something to say. George Clooney thought that Alec must have done something irresponsible, that he should have checked the gun for live rounds.
Yeah.
That's probably the most valid criticism, is that, like, before you handle the gun, you should always yourself check. For, you know, cause if he had done that, she would be alive.
Yeah. I really have nothing to say, because I'm waiting for, like, a real investigation and all the information to come out. Because, like, it's like, I saw the documentary recreation of when, what was that movie with The Crow?
The Crow?
Yeah, where they investigated that.
Brandon Lee.
And the police, you know, made their whole report and about the whole incident. I'm waiting for that because I don't know if I can trust Alec Baldwin. I don't know if I can trust the media. I don't know if I can trust any of this. I'm just going to wait for the whole report with all the information and we'll figure that out.
Well, it is weird to see an A-list actor talk about a very real situation.
Mm.
It's weird to watch somebody whose profession, and he's at the top of his profession, try to speak earnestly on any topic, because I my brain is trained to be like, well, this man is highly, highly skilled at bullshitting us.
Of course. And and all of the crew was saying it was people were striking and I don't buy it. I have no idea what's going on.
That just sounds like aggrieved employees that were unhappy about other aspects of the shoot. And then were like, see, I knew someone was going to die. It just feels so real. It feels so like that to me.
Yeah. I don't know. It was,
but what do I know? I was not on the set of Rust.
Rust. When's that coming out? Really?
I'm a little bummed that the movie's not coming out. It looks like kind of a cool movie.
But no.
But I feel bad for him. Look, one thing we can say confidently without an investigation is Alec Baldwin's not a murderer.
It's obviously an accident. Even if, like, there are accusations that he lost his temper and actually pulled the trigger, like, just to intimidate her.
Wow.
That was the accusation that I've heard, but I don't know. I think it might be BS because there's lots of BS floating around. Because
I mean, it sounded very credible that they were the director, the cinematographer, and the main actor were staging a shot, and they weren't even shooting. It's just terribly sad, no matter what way you slice it. And so, is the director gonna live? Do we know anything about him?
I haven't heard anything. And if he has a story to tell, then we can figure out what this whole situation was about.
I can't even imagine. You ever driving your car and you have a little bit of a close call where you're like, imagine if I just killed a person then with my fucking car. And maybe somebody in your life, like, you know, a friend of a friend or a relative or something, that like somebody who like, oh yeah, like they accidentally killed that person with their car. It's just so, you know, split second and you can't take it back. And it was just a moment of negligence. It's like, that's the stuff of nightmares, man.
No, I'm actually a big fan of Alec Baldwin. Like I love him in 30 Rock. I think he's a great actor. So I do know he has like a weird temper because there's like that clip of him yelling at
calling his daughter a pig,
calling him a thoughtless pig.
You fucking pig!
A thoughtless pig. And then like he like beat up a paparazzi and like somebody like took his parking spot or something. And he like attacked that person. So there's weird stuff. Again, I'm not accusing Alec Baldwin of anything. I'm gonna wait for all that information to come out. Outside of his own like PR campaign, and we'll figure that out.
The Boss Baby himself.
The Boss Baby. Will there be a Boss Baby 3? We don't know.
I don't know that I can answer that right now.
She was my friend. She was my friend.
She was my friend, Templeton. Put the coffee down. Put the trigger down. Have you ever seen She's Having a Baby?
No.
Well, it's a great movie. If you want a good romantic comedy, like there ain't too many good romantic comedies out there. It's John Hughes. I think he directed it even. And it's Kevin Bacon is the star. Alec Baldwin is like the cool friend in it. And he's quite young. He is real young and real sexy. I mean, this is pre-Beetlejuice.
Oh, man.
And yeah. And... And he's just whispering the whole movie.
Oh,
he's like,
perfect.
If you get out of that car and marry that girl, it's gonna change your life. whole movie is that so much that we want. Like my kid loves Boss Baby, and I was like, do you want to see the guy who does Boss Baby? And I played a clip from She's Having a Baby, and she was like, turn the shit off. But it's a great movie. It's about a couple that gets married, a young couple that gets married, and then the first couple of years of their marriage, and then they have a child, and it's, this is all the movie is. And, you know, and the birthing experience is almost complicated by, you know, an injury and stuff. And but it's just a really, really, really strong 80s romantic comedy. I highly recommend it. It's great. I now I got to go watch She's Having a Baby right away. So what else we got? We did our shoot.
Oh,
we
yeah.
shot the holiday special. That was fun.
I had a lot of fun. I had, like, shooting blue balls.
I've now edited the Pirate Pizza review segment. That's finished. And I've edited half of You Know What's False Graph, because we had shot two angles on it, and I fucked up, and I didn't transfer the data for the second angle. And I went home pretty depressed about it. I was like, I can't believe I fucked that up. So I felt very obligated to, like, make, like, to lock in that edit and make that one angle work. And it, after you left the shoot, I got a ton of B-roll of the actual false graph. And so that's one way to diversify the edit. And then I'm using full slates for his questions. I'm putting score numbers above our heads with dings. And it's actually really, you know, I play tense thinking music every time he asks a question. It's going to be great.
I got really into true or false graph. It was really fun. And I'm not a competitive person, but John brings that out in me.
It's such an absurd game in the first place. Actually, because so we shot quite a few, you know, then we did a big unboxing, then we did a cooking segment, you did your coffee mead, and then we did the Christmas cactus, and then tomorrow, the Swansea Mall, which we've done a Junth Card on, that abandoned Swansea Mall is going to have Santa in the original location. They're going to invite people into the abandoned mall. I was like, fuck, dude. Like, if ever there's been a reason for an emergency shoot, it's that. So I think that we're getting another segment. So it's going to be a huge holiday special. And because we're not, like, have to release something every Sunday, I'm like, fuck it. I'm going to edit this thing until it's done. It's going to be one episode. It's not going to be a James Rolfe three-parter. And, you know, I don't know when I'll be finished with it, but if it's got to be before December 25th. That's all that matters. And so, yeah, it could be the 23rd. It could be Christmas Day. I don't know. But I'll be working steadily on it all December. And I'm pretty, pretty excited about it. And so I would like to release some other content in the meanwhile. I was thinking about, in prep of True or False Graph, posting the clip of That's Too Much from 2012. When we played John's game show that one time, I re-listened to it. It's very funny. It's very, very appropriate for the main channel too, because it's such a precursor to John's Cart and to Box Mac.
Yeah, I love all of his, like, game shows that he did. I'm like that.
Like he introduces the audience in that one to Building 19. He talks about, like, his box cereal. His Kia Amante. And he's like, I see a cartridge of Super Mario World for SNES. How much do I pay? And in 2012, it was like $20 would be like a bit too much money for him for a car. And
that's
now, like,
too much.
You're paying more for an SMW cart than $20. That's for sure.
Yeah. It reminds me of when we went to, the Rainham Flea and
he bought up, like, those fake games.
And then, remember we saw that RGB, like, monitor there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and as a matter of fact, the vendor, his nephew is a huge fan of ours and was like, I can get that monitor for you.
I was actually looking at monitors like that on eBay today. So I was thinking.
Well, shit, you should come down. We should, you know, during the month of December, Rainham Flea is open Saturdays and Sundays. And Saturdays, it's free admission.
Oh, dang.
Just saying.
Just do follow-up.
Yeah, I'll go there anytime. There's a couple of bits of entertainment I just want to talk about real quick. There was the South Park special, the post-COVID special.
Yeah, I saw that.
Pretty funny, I thought. I heard somebody, they were like, it was fine. I was like, well, come on, it is better than fine.
It was probably me.
It's still, like, one of the wittiest shows out there.
Yeah, it's definitely got more integrity. I found myself not laughing that much. I thought it was like, oh, that's clever. Oh, that's clever. Oh, that's clever. Like, it wasn't laugh out loud funny, but it was entertaining. I love, I love like Cartman, like where he ended up. And I love how it's still like a mind fuck. What, like, is he actually, did he actually start a family to fuck with Kyle?
It's like just unclear. It will always be unclear.
Yeah, and it's unclear to him. It's unclear to Kyle. And
he's just so deep in it now. I love Kenny for some reason. Kenny becomes this kind of eccentric billionaire, like genius type.
Yeah, with a big beard and like
that's
always trying to talk, but everyone's interrupting him. It's great.
So even if it's not like, I don't know, even if it doesn't capture the audience the way South Park did at one time, I still feel like you're not getting anything like this on anywhere else on TV.
No.
I mean, this is still a really unique show. And I think the reason that it might not work as well as it once did is not really its fault. I think it's the world that's changed. It's hard. It's, you know, South Park was a show made for a different time.
Yeah, it was a lot of shock humor, a lot of I'm trying to like put my finger on it. What I think it's.
Well, first of all, it's hard. It's really hard to comment on the world as it currently stands. Like they really ran into this with Trump, where it was like, well, how do you make satire about him? You know, it's like I know how the Jimmys would do it, but how do we do it? And it was like, well, we can't, because he's a comedian. Trump is doing comedy.
I did like Jimmy the
the
woke.
Every joke is just a compliment.
Yeah, love it.
And the fact that his fucking name is Jimmy is just so perfect.
Yeah, it's perfect.
So I enjoyed it, and I do own Paramount Plus because we watched that new Alvin and Chipmunks show. So I guess it worked out for me. And they're December 16th. They're doing a follow up, so there's already a new one coming right out.
Hey. Yeah.
So I guess their seasons now are just little hour long shows. It's kind of cool.
I do miss like just 20-minute standalone episodes.
Yeah, I'm with you. Well, because they over the last 10 years or so, they've gotten more into like repeating the joke, like the, you know, kind of going hard on one concept, which I think can be really funny, but not for an hour it can't, you know.
Yeah.
But for a half hour, you know, like Tegrity Farms at this point is like very played out.
Yeah.
I'm like really okay without it, you know.
Exactly. Like I almost prefer Randy separated from that.
Yeah, I'm with you. Make a Randy show if you must. And I saw the Kevin Smith documentary Clerk, which was directed by Kevin's friend Malcolm Ingram. And I would say, as a comprehensive document of a fairly unique career, a guy who kind of revolutionized indie cinema at one time and then innovated himself and his own brand several times over since then. I think it was pretty cool. It was like they had to fit the whole thing into 2 hours, from Clerks to every other movie he's done to his Daredevil comics to animated series to his heart attack. Like, it's all there. And, you know, when he got married and when he had a kid and the podcasting, and that you have to tell it in a way that flows. And so some of it had to go kind of out of order. But as somebody who's been following his career basically for as long as he's had one, it was just interesting to see it all. Like, it's all there, it's all condensed, and it was a well-made documentary. And yeah, it's a damn unique career, you know, even when the guy is making us all cringe. I've always had, and I will always will have respect for Kevin's willingness to, try new things and obviously his loyalty to his friend group. And it does kind of feel like he was made more for YouTube than for Hollywood, but he kind of got in with Hollywood at that. You know, he broke in at a strange time.
Yeah. I mean, I obviously love Clerks and Clerks Too. Like, I love Clerks Too. It's one of those movies that is kind of, some people are divided on, but I thought it was a fun, energetic thing for the time. And then, you can't help but respect him, even if he's a little bit annoying sometimes.
Yeah, he's a little bit annoying, and that's okay. You know, you got to be a little annoying. But I'll use that as a quick and easy transition to, I finished his He-Man show, because the second part of his He-Man show came out. So they had released 5 episodes of Masters of the Universe Revelations for Netflix, and now they've released the second half. And I think I touched upon it in the first podcast, the drama over this thing that sort of overshadowed all of it was, despite having an amazing score, expensive animation, Mark Hamill is the voice of Skeletor, Kevin Smith is executive producer, and a lot of excitement from Mattel and from fans, it became obvious during the marketing that it wasn't going to be about He-Man, that they were going to pull a Justice League and kill him, and it would instead be about Teela. And they kind of fashioned Teela into more of like a kind of stereotypical, like, you know, strong woman type character that is played out. They gave her this ridiculous haircut and stuff. And so everybody was saying, like, is this a bait and switch? Are you telling me to watch a He-Man show and then you're not going to give me a He-Man show? And, like, if you want to do female He-Man, don't you have She-Ra? And shouldn't you just make a She-Ra show? You know? And it's that Kevin went out there and was like, not at all. Untrue. This is not true, what you're saying. And then the five episodes, it's like, yeah, he was killed in the first episode, and it's totally the Teela show. Now I've seen the second half, which not nearly as many people are commenting on, and doesn't have nearly the same level of animus, nor like nobody, I don't even think it really had much viewership. But
yeah, well, people checked out after the first five.
People checked out, yeah. But I think Prince Adam and He-Man were in like just about every episode in this one. He comes back. And so, to be fair to Kevin, these five episodes have a whole lot of He-Man in them. That's not to say it doesn't still focus on these secondary characters, but he's definitely there. And then, most comical of all, like, despite all of this sort of socio-cultural, political drama over it, it became obvious that the last episode was the reason the whole thing was made. The last episode is just very expensive animation of all the He-Man toys fighting. This is all it is.
That's all you needed.
And I was like, why don't you just make this one show, this one episode, and release that and hope for the best with your action figure series? Because it's like, I don't think that all the filler to get to this point was necessary. I think you could have just cut to here. We're like, now Skeletor's got the power and he's huge and he's going to fight He-Man. And Teela's going to fight Evil-Lyn. And, you know, Man-at-Arms gives his arms to this other person. And that's just all it was. Surely that's all Mattel Television wanted it to be. Maybe Netflix was like, hey, make it a bit woke, would you?
Yeah, or maybe, I don't know. Yeah, it didn't have to be a weird, awkward culture war thing.
It did not. Like Ghostbusters 2016 before it. And I'm not saying specifically like, oh, they should have told the story in this other way or something. All I'm saying is like, it's obvious to me why you made the product, to sell it. And yeah, you sacrifice sales for these kind of incidental culture war thing. I don't know. It doesn't make sense to me. But I'll end with this on He-Man. I never was a fan as a kid. I don't care about He-Man at all.
No,
I never did. I was always a Power Rangers guy or whatever.
Yeah, it was before my time.
Yeah, it was before my time. I'm a little too young for it. I'm 35. And I thought, well, this expensive Netflix revival of it kind of made more for adults. Maybe that'll be my way into He-Man. Maybe I'll like finally have some like working knowledge of He-Man. And I watched 10 hours, right? No, 5 hours. I watched 5 hours of He-Man content, and I don't know anything about He-Man. I don't know the first fucking thing about it. I know the characters' names. I don't know what Castle Grayskull is. I don't know.
I don't know either. I know he has the power. That's all I know. Right.
He's got that. Yeah, that's for sure. They talk about the power. I don't know what it is. I it didn't bring me any closer to the brand watching it for all that time.
You know, there's like a green cat, right?
Yep, Cringer. His name is Cringer.
I'm very cringy.
Very cringy. Very Cringer.
Do you want to talk about Hawkeye?
Yeah, let's do it. We'll end on Hawkeye.
It's good. it's like one of those things where it's like, it's good. Marvel. I think these Marvel TV shows, man.
Yeah, I thought Loki was quite bad at the end of the day.
At the end of the day. I thought it was a great premise. Some interesting stuff at the end with Kang, but the middle was awful.
I thought Falcon and Winter Soldier had enough going for it to not write it off. Like, yeah. Between Zemo and her, it had enough going for it.
I think it suffered from editing out like a big virus plot.
Yeah.
Which I think was to his detriment. And then
WandaVision is mwah, like, except for all the crap we've already talked about, but most of it is very, very, very good.
And I was thinking, why do I like Hawkeye and WandaVision? And it's like they're both similar. It's like dealing with trauma. Because when that scene in the most recent episode where, Clint is talking to Kate about his, it's like when he's talking about his trauma, like how he's,
all of these shows are about mental health. WandaVision is about grief. Falcon and Winter Soldier is about PTSD and guilt. And in the case of Falcon, it's obviously about discrimination.
And thinking if you're actually, ready for the role or ready for being Captain America.
It's imposter syndrome stuff. So. Yeah. And then Loki is all about, narcissism. And self-absorption, and now this is about trauma and about
there were so many good scenes, like, or it's all one scene where he's talking about like he's just like a weapon. Clint is talking about he's a weapon, but he was just like pointed by the right people at the right things.
Yeah, that's cool.
And it's really interesting. And then like when all those people went away during the blip, it's like what do you do? where am I going to be pointed to?
Do you ever think, stop while you're watching it? You're like, I'm watching this kind of, mid-budget television series, mid to high budget television series starring Hawkeye and the True Grit girl. And you pause and you're like, this is a sequel to a 2012, $200 million movie. This is funny to me. Like they're, in the audience's mind, those two, that movie and this show are very linked, but like they are separated by quite a bit. I mean, first of all, they're separated by like 9 years.
Yeah.
And two, like they don't really match in style and tone. That's one of the coolest things about Marvel is that you have essentially sequels to things that don't resemble one another. Yeah.
And like Hawkeye as a character hasn't ever been given the space to do what he's doing now. And Jeremy Renner, who's a Oscar caliber actor, is able to actually do this within a Marvel property. Do that.
Yeah, it gives the character. I don't know if they're going to retire the character or what, but it certainly like casts much like it did for Wanda. Actually, if I ever go back and watch Age of Ultron, I'm going to enjoy it more because Wanda and Hawkeye are better developed in future shows.
Yeah. It's so funny. Yeah. Cause if you were like, if you saw Age of Ultron, you're like, okay, next we're doing a Hawkeye thing. Next we're doing a Wanda thing. You'd be like, fuck off.
I was, that's why we were me and Zach Maxwell were laughing. Cause I was like, I can't now that the unexpected shows are good. I can't just write them off.
It's like, yeah,
I don't know what's going to be good. I thought Loki was going to be pretty good. It wasn't.
Yeah. So you,
I thought that would be the best. If you had asked me what will be, rank what you think the quality of these four shows would be, I would have gotten it perfectly wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
But I've always liked Hawkeye as a concept because I like the whole Batman thing, where it's like, it's a normal guy hanging around superheroes. He can do a couple things well. Maybe he's rich. Maybe he's really good shooting a bow. I don't care. It's cool. It's cool that you could look up to that person and maybe you could realize it.
I like that.
And that's kind of built into the show too, because that's what Kate's doing. She's looking up to this guy who was fighting against insurmountable odds. And she is trying to take up that mantle.
And it's a good metaphor too for like, when am I ever going to be able to be with my family? Like, when am I going to stop working? When am I going to stop being at work all the time? which, you know, kind of echoes like with Falcon. In his case, it was like, hey, I'm a superhero, but I'm broke. and I, you know, I can't make a living off of this. And this is kind of like, my line of work is in the way of what I care about. And Endgame positions Hawkeye Clint in a really cool place, which is he lost everything for 5 years and now he has it back. And what does his life look like now that he has everybody back? That shouldn't he have a new lease on life? And I think he recognizes, like, I probably should have a new lease on life. And yet I'm kind of like back in the stupid thick of things, shooting stupid arrows. And I don't want to be shooting stupid arrows anymore. And before he saved his family, he really, really was committed to the idea of sacrificing his own life. But now he's the one who survived. And I think he feels like it definitely should have been Natasha that lived and him who's dead. So I think he also feels like he's on borrowed time. Like I'm not the one who should be here. And it's kind of cool to watch a show about a guy who's like, I don't think I should be here.
Yeah. And Jeremy Renner plays it so well because he's, you know, Hurt Locker shit. He's got that tortured soldier affect to him. And, and he brings it all to the table and he doesn't phone it in. He's acting. He's acting his butt off. And it's great to see that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Actually, I'm with you, man. The shows are really good ideas for these characters.
And I like Kate Bishop. I like the actress, what she's bringing to the table. I like every aspect of this. I pretty much like. I mean, there's obviously things where, you know, maybe don't work completely, but it's good. I like it. I like the humor.
There's your movie marathon. 8-Bit Christmas. She's having a baby. True Grit. You can't go wrong with that line. That is just like, that is a wonderful day at the movies in your basement. I recommend that. Well, that's all I got. I gotta get back to editing.
Yeah,
because that's what I'm doing all December.
And I gotta go wash my dishes.
Dishes. I'm worried that with the elliptical broken, I won't be able to consume media at the same rate. But maybe I should be editing instead.
No.
But like I said at the beginning of the podcast, it's good to have your routine disrupted because then you might actually innovate it.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
That's what we need to do. Maybe I can double my revenue, my ad revenue.
Your workout revenue.
Red Cow Arcade.